Good afternoon, and may it please the Court, I would like to reserve, if I may, 2 minutes for rebuttal. Before I get into my argument, I just would like to briefly say that I am grateful and humbled to be here in this Court on this historic day to try to breathe life into my client's Sixth Amendment right to counsel. If this Court does nothing today, my client serves 28 months of a 32-month sentence. If you release my client today, he serves 25 months of an 18-month sentence. Either result is unfair. But what this really boils down to is a three-month period of time. Within 3 months of today, April 15th, he'll be released no matter whether you do something or do nothing.
Now, has he been placed in some sort of a halfway facility? Is that where he is now?
He's been placed in a Great Falls pre-release center, and he was placed there on or around December 16th or 18th.
Okay, so he's still technically in custody, but he's not in prison at the moment. Okay.
And we chose to abandon a motion to release pending appeal in the district court so that wouldn't interfere with that transfer.
Okay.
Now, my argument is simply this. Because the district court should have used the multiple counts of conviction rules under the guidelines, the sentence should have been 18 months instead of two 16-month sentences.
Well, we've got a very unusual case here. This doesn't happen very often in my experience. We basically have two separate sentencings. In fact, the second sentence is based on a different charge or theory of prosecution than he was facing the first time around, right?
Different, but somewhat connected, Your Honor. He refused to plead guilty to count three, the gun count, and he pled guilty to counts one and two. So they charged him with transferring a firearm as well as ammunition to a convicted felon.
Well, he didn't want to plead to transferring the firearm, which is the theory of prosecution the first time around, right?
Correct.
And so you were not able to work it out through a plea agreement, so they recharged him with supplying the ammunition.
Correct.
So I don't know if it's still, what, a 922G violation or whatever the...
It's the same statute, but it doesn't carry the mandatory minimum five, and it's really become the guideline.
I mean, it's issue. Different conduct that lead
right.
with a different punishment.
Right.
So that's why I said earlier, it's very unusual procedurally in my experience, because we do have different crimes, even though, as you argue, they arose out of the same drug transaction that got him convicted of the narcotics.
And I would add to that, it's really different procedurally, because not only was there a second case, but as the government pointed out in its reply in the supplemental excerpt, there's a middle case where my client did attempt to plead guilty to the amended charge. In fact, the judge hadn't called it a superseding information, and the judge didn't accept the plea because he wouldn't admit the gun part of it, although he'd admit the ammunition part of it.
Right.
And I think that basically resulted in this whole three different cause number mess and an additional time that my client's doing. Because not only did he have to wait 4 months between the time he pled to the drug charges in the original case, he had to wait another 4 months after he pled to the transfer of ammunition charge.
But the interesting thing to me, and this is why it's procedurally unusual, the grouping guideline sections are written in contemplation of a single sentencing proceeding in which the defendant is being sentenced on multiple counts. And that didn't happen here. So the guideline really doesn't address this procedural situation, does it, Mr. Donovan?
It really doesn't, but I'm saying that's what should have happened here. Because essentially, and it's on page 15 of the supplemental excerpts, the judge hadn't basically recognized that, and I'll quote it, it is my understanding, counsel, from the materials provided to the court, that it is the defendant's intention to have the court consider a change of plea to a superseding information that has been filed in this case, in which is to be instead or in lieu of the continuation of count three of the charges now pending.
But he'd already been sentenced once, right? By the time all
at that point in time, he hadn't been sentenced yet. But at the point of time where they actually filed the indictment with the new charge, he had been sentenced. That was within a month or two after he got sentenced in August of 2007.
Right, and that's why I say that this is really not the situation that the guidelines contemplate. This idea of you get sentenced in essence on part of the case, the drug part first, and then you reenter into negotiations, and eventually you work out a deal with regard to the firearm charge, the ammunition charge, and he pleads guilty to a superseding, what, information that charged?
They didn't accept the plea to the superseding information. He actually pled guilty to an indictment in cause number 106.
Which is a new cause number.
Right. So he went through the third cause. But it's so unusual, I'm saying that this is so unusual, it didn't never happen before, it'll probably never happen again, and that these multiple conviction guidelines should apply.
What is your argument? You can't rely on the guidelines. This is not a sentencing guideline problem. It's clearly inconsistent with what you're arguing. Now, what is your position? I don't understand what your argument is, then, it's not a guideline sentence.
Well, I'm saying that if you apply the, it is the extent I'm saying that the multiple counts of conviction guidelines should apply to get a combined guideline range.
But the Sentencing Commission hasn't put that in the guidelines.
Well,
the Sentencing Commission says if it's the same indictment and the same sentencing, you'll group them and take the highest and so forth. That's not your case. So what is your argument? It's not the guidelines.
Well, I can only get to, I guess, the result that my client wants if I use the guidelines and say this was so unfair, so unusual that these things happened the way they did in the charge in cause number 106, the receiving the firearms, is really a substituted charge of count 3 in the original indictment, that the guidelines do apply.
Well,
so I don't know if that's a leap of faith or a fiction I'm asking for or what.
No, I can see your argument. The problem I'm having in accepting is, let's suppose that the supplying of the ammunition had occurred on a completely different day, 2 months before, and then the drug deal happens down the road. Would the grouping rules still apply if he were indicted and convicted of multiple counts where there was
clearly, if they're in the same indictment, but I have a much weaker argument that it's a different time period of time, and it's not.
I mean, your theory has to be that the supplying of the ammunition and buying the gun, which was then carried to the drug transaction, was all part and parcel of a continuing criminal transaction.
Well,
that would be the strongest case. We stopped by Walmart on our way to the drug deal to pick up a weapon to protect the drug deal.
Yeah, and it's apparently on a videotape of him buying the ammunition.
Well, he doesn't deny that, right? He's been willing to admit all along that he bought the ammunition at Walmart and gave it to his nephew.
That's correct. So in the process of denying and refusing to plead guilty to the gun count, he basically admits the ammunition charge.
The video showed him buying the gun, though, too, didn't it? If it showed him buying the ammunition, wouldn't it show him buying the gun?
I believe that's true. I was in trial counsel. I believe you're right.
So was this just a moral thing with Mr. Gray? He just couldn't?
Well,
supplying the nephew with the gun?
I'd have to go outside the record
to talk about that.
But he firmly convinced that he didn't know his nephew was
going to bring the gun. To the drug deal. Okay. If you want to save some time for rebuttal.
I'll reserve. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Carl Rosted with the U.S. Attorney's Office out of Great Falls. Judge Tallman, just to clarify for the record, the gun was one that Mr. Gray previously owned. It wasn't.
So he didn't buy it at Walmart?
No, it was his gun. He got it through pawn in an earlier transaction, and they kept it at the apartment that he and Mr. Graham shared. His position was always that Mr. Graham had somehow stolen the gun and then taken it to the drug deal, and he didn't know that that was occurring. That's how he distanced himself from the gun. The only problem with that story was, then why were you buying ammunition for a gun that you didn't think he was going to go take? Anyway, it really gets confusing.
Mr. Ross, let's go back to the actual facts of this case.
Yes, sir.
In the PSR, the facts are identical identical, word for word, in the other charge. Why is this being treated differently?
Because Mr. Gray insisted that it would be treated differently. Remember,
you want to punish him, a non-lawyer. He admits at the end of the colloquy, and I didn't do the gun, I did the ammunition, sir. And the court said, well, we're not going to do this because you're not admitting to what you said. It looks to me like this is a pretty vindictive thing on the part of the government, where on the one hand you say in the PSR, this is exactly what the other charge was, and then you turn around and you sock him with this additional time. Why is that wrong?
That is, the PSR was the same series of events. There's no question. Mm-hmm. But here's the distinction. Mr. Gray has always said that the ammunition and the gun had no part in the drug deal, that the only relevance that they had to one another is their proximity.
Why didn't the PSR get written up differently then? Why didn't you say, well, this is part of a different deal? But it reads identical to the word. Why is this not the same?
That could have been laziness on part of the probation office, or they just included the facts as they all developed on that day.
I understand, but we have to deal with the record as we have it here. And I guess I'm having real difficulty understanding, other than just vindictiveness, why this is being done in this way. The government, had this man said, hey, the gun and the ammunition, he'd have been sentenced, without a doubt, to a much, much lower sentence, would he not, by several months?
If it had all occurred in the same time, yes, sir.
That's what the plea agreement was, according to what went down originally. Instead, he says, and for whatever reason, no, I didn't do the gun. I did the ammunition, I admit that. And all of a sudden, he gets treated as this is an entirely different crime, and yet the PSR doesn't say that.
Right, Your Honor. That's... And again, getting back to the PSR, all I can say is the government, the United States Attorney's Office didn't write the PSR. All we were doing was holding him accountable for giving a gun to a felon. Now, when we our
he
first theory
plead to that,
but he wouldn't plead to that.
So the district court said, "I can't take your plea if you're not going to admit that that's what you did."
Right.
Okay.
And so we went off and backed up and said, "Well, then we will." Well, here's the series. First of all, the 924C is use of a firearm. That's the big one, 5 years mandatory consecutive. Refused to plead to it, pled guilty to the two drug charges without a plea agreement. So then we discuss it further, and we say, well, all right, if we take his stance, we said at the time with his then counsel, that he's not 924C, then he certainly admitted giving the ammunition, and the gun was his, so we assumed that he also gave that to his nephew. And so we wrote it up, and he signed the plea agreement, and then we went to the second aborted hearing where he said, no, I'm going to stand by the thing. I didn't give him the gun. Well, then we haul in the nephew to discuss whether for the prosecution to stand, whether are we going to return to the 924C theory, or are we going to stick with the 922D, which is giving firearm or ammunition to a felon. And it was just this sequence of events through Mr. Gray's proceeding that got us there.
Well, let's be clear about this. Mr. Gray is a non-lawyer. Does the record indicate, or can you tell this court, what happened between the government and defense counsel that resulted in what is, to me, a pissing contest?
Well, I don't know that it was, Your Honor. We were trying to get the right charge to fit what the government could live with and what the defendant could live with. And there was that one time when thought we had a deal with Mr. Gray because he, you know, in our conversations with the attorney, he didn't come back to us and say rewrite the plea agreement or anything like that. We thought we had a deal going in, and that's when Mr. Gray said, "Well, now that I've thought about it, it's not on the gun charge, or I'm not going to plead that I did anything with the gun," which caused Judge Haddon to indicate that he wasn't going to accept the plea.
Mm-hmm.
So then we had to go back and say, okay, now it just was one of those modifications, Your Honor, that kept on going and on going and on going. But it was all in response to Mr. Gray telling us what he'd be willing to plead guilty to.
The dealings with Mr. Gray's counsel were amicable, and everyone was just having a great time.
Yes, sir. Mr. Gray, Your Honor, is more obstreperous and difficult than his counsel was.
Interesting.
Our theory, Your Honor, for the purposes of the argument, though, is twofold. We suggest to the court that Mr. Gray's current position can't be that the district court was wrong in not grouping, because, as the court has pointed out, grouping only applies to proceedings that occur on the same day in the same sentencing. it is difficult to aspire or to give error to the court for not grouping for something that the guideline said he shouldn't do anyway. Even if you assume that the sentencing had occurred on the same day, there's also ample law that says because the two crimes focus on two different societal interests, that they wouldn't be appropriate necessarily for a concurrent sentence anyway or grouped together for that purpose, and that two consecutive sentences could have been given. And therefore, Your Honor, we don't believe that there was any error in this case. As muddled as it was, sometimes the prosecution of cases isn't as easy, clear, and quick as...
Well, I mean, we have the benefit of hindsight, and it seems to me, had I been representing Mr. Gray at that point, defense counsel should have moved for a continuance of the sentencing on the narcotics charge, or at least tried to talk his client out of entering a plea to anything at that point until the lawyer could work out an acceptable deal on the firearm / ammunition issue. But defense never asked for it, and Gray said, I want to plead to the drug charge, so Judge Hatton took the plea, and then he sentenced him.
And that could have been a tactical decision in his defense on his part, thinking that if the drug charges were disposed of, that the government wouldn't continue to be concerned about the firearm, or excuse me, the ammunition. If the court has no further questions, I thank you for your time.
All right. Mr. Bonner?
One significant fact I'd like to point out in relation to the government's argument here, if you look on in the government's supplemental excerpts of record, I don't think they're marked page-wise, but on the plea agreement that Mr. Gray signed that went into the cause number 042, of course, it wasn't known it was 042 apparently until later, Mr. Gray actually crossed out the part of the elements charge that he had given a handgun to his nephew. And that plea agreement was filed 4 days before the aborted change of plea hearing. At the aborted change of plea hearing, the judge basically took the position, well, you aren't complete guilty of this, we're going to trial next week, forcing this whole thing to get dismissed, and I wasn't there at the time, but it couldn't get resolved, unfortunately.
But am I correct? His lawyer did not ask at that point for a continuance.
Not that I see in the record.
Okay. No. And Gray apparently was willing and insisted on entering the plea to the drug charge at that point, leaving unresolved the issue of what are we going to do about the firearm ammunition charge.
This, as I read it, would have been before the sentencing, the drug charge, and could have resulted in possibly a consolidation. And when Mr. Gray went to court, because the plea agreement there was no number on the plea agreement he signed, apparently, until it was filed, he had reason to believe that it was the same proceeding, 06, the original proceeding.
Pardon me. We haven't said anything about this, but this contention that you're making here was never presented to the trial court, was it? We review for plain error, if any error, don't we?
That's correct, but my contention is plain error would apply because if my argument is correct, then the guidelines are miscalculated, and I think that fits the plain error rule. The last thing I'd just like to mention is...
Well, if they apply, right? I mean,
If
we decide the grouping guidelines don't apply, then there can't be error.
Then I'm out of here.
Okay.
But anyway, I'll be
appreciate
out of here.
Appreciate your candor, right?
But I would ask the court if you're inclined to rule my way to do so soon or to consider releasing.
We understand the urgency. Thanks, Mr. Donovan. And I thank both counsel for their argument. The case just argued is submitted.